Yes, we frequently confront this problem. You know, we want to do certain things. Even if you go to a library, before you go to the library, you have made up mind, you read Emerson, you want to read Aristotle, you want to read spiritual classics, or Bible, or whatever it is. But when you read there, you find some flashy magazines and books. We won't do it. So you often find if you get a strong decision if you make, there is somebody else who comes in between and drags you away from your decision to read this particular book. I'm just giving a very simple, ordinary experience. Now, and in our life also, if we can always practice what we want to practice, if we can do what we want to do, there will be very few problems in this world. Itishwarananda, yes. Meditation and spiritual practice. Yes, yes.
And he uses a lot of the Sanskrit words, his definitions, I think, are very illuminating. There's a depth of it. He talks about Buddhi, and it's the first time I've come across it again. I've come across it in the past, but he says, like, Buddhi is sort of your spiritual intelligence, and
that
with time,
yeah,
and I guess practice,
it
sort of reveals itself.
Yeah. This Buddhi or intellect becomes a spiritual tool as a result of spiritual practices. In fact, one way to bridge the gap between the intellect and mind is to continue our efforts to practice, to do spiritual practices. So that will create more and more vrittis and vasanas, good samskaras in the mind. The conflict is due to the opposing camps, opposing groups of categories of samskaras. There are many samskaras in our mind which are helpful, positive, very helpful. And there are some samskaras which are not so very helpful. So this clash, this confrontation, is the reason why we are not able always to implement what we want to do, In fact, many problems of this multiple personality and schizophrenia are analyzed by some psychologists and psychiatrists who believe in law of karma because we have accumulated different mutually contradictory samskaras and vasanas in previous life. So they emerge and they influence. They drag your mind in one direction and another set of samskaras drag into opposite direction. So one method, one way out of the problem is to continue our efforts to feed our mind with good thoughts, good samskaras, by seeing good things, reading good books, discussing good ideas. So if bad samskaras, bad actions have created bad samskaras, good samskaras can create good samskaras. So when the mind will have more of good samskaras, good impressions, then your mind will cooperate with you, your buddhi will cooperate with you, then you'll be able to do what you want to do. Suppose you want to, you should take a decision and to meditate today. Tomorrow onwards, I shall meditate for 2 hours. But when the time comes, it may not be always possible. So our mind, a part of our mind, detaches itself from its main body and creates a false justification for not doing meditation at that time. Oh, maybe I will do tomorrow to have an important engagement. Maybe I will do tomorrow. Why? Because a part of our mind is not cooperating. The other part is cooperating. Because a lot of good samskaras will help you to evolve a mindset which cooperates with you. It's opposite. A lot of maybe some bad samskaras may create a mindset which may create a false justification for not doing it. But so one way out of the problem is to continue the effort. So this effort will create more of good samskaras, and then slowly we'll be able to do that. That's abhyasa is a word mentioned in the Gita. I can elaborate this point. In the 12th chapter, there is an interesting verse. Mayeva mana adatsva mai buddhim nivesya nivasishyasi mayeva ata urdham na samsaya. The highest level of spiritual life, devotional life. Your mind and your intellect always merge in God. God lives in your mind and you mentally live in God. But it's a very high state. Only great mystics will have it. What about those who have not reached this state? The next alternative is given in the 9th verse, 12th chapter. He says, try to practice it. How to do that? Your actions, your thought currents, your mental and emotional and intellectual activities, give them a spiritual orientation. So giving a spiritual orientation to our natural tendencies, to our natural activities, will give them a spiritual direction. So that will help you to reach that stage gradually. So this will bridge the gap between intellect and mind. Yes, you know, well, buddhi in Vedanta is a technical definition for buddhi. Nisyatmika antakarnavurthi buddhi is a definition. Means buddhi is a desiderative faculties, faculty with which you decide what you do. That's a sense in which buddhi is used in the particular verse which I quoted. So you want to do something. You have a decision, nischaya means decision. You have decided to do something. Mind, on the other hand, is sankalpa vikalpatmika antakarna vritti. Means mind is always a speculative mode. I want to do this. And also, another part of the mind says, I want to do something else. When you decide to do this, it is buddhi or intellect. So the gap between the two is a common problem for all beginners in spiritual life. Because of conflicting samskaras and vrittis coming from previous life and also from this life, they drag you in different directions. So one method out of the problem, one way out of the problem is to continue this effort. So that will slowly equip your mind better for spiritual endeavor.
The struggle I have is how to reach the contentment definition of how much I need to do in each one of these areas, or areas like that.
Yeah.
Intellectually, I'm not able to put a limit or a line to say, I'm content with what I've done for my children, I'm content with what I'm doing for my mother, or I'm content with what I'm helping my company succeed in the marketplace.
Well, once you feel that you have done your best for your children or to do justice to your profession, once you feel that you have done your best, then you need not worry about more and more ambitions, because there is no end to that. So in a way, there is no end to the goal, that different goals that we can think of. But there is an end to what we can consider ourselves to be our best. So our profession and what it enables us to do for the children, for society, there's a limit to that. So once you do your best, then we need not worry about that discontentment or dissatisfaction that you may feel, well, I have not done more. That need not worry. Because there again, mind is playing, you know. So you need not worry about it. But there is no end to that kind of discontentment. One way to do is the ability to remain non-attached. Non-attachment, remember, is a very positive virtue. It doesn't mean indifference or negligence, not at all. It doesn't mean Vedanta and yoga gives great importance to human relations, the intimacy of human relations, sanctity of human relations, very paramount, very important. But sometimes reaches a point of enslavement. You feel enslaved, you feel obsessed with something. To avoid that problem, the word non-attachment is used. Non-attachment only means non-obsession, non-enslavement in a spiritual, psychological sense. That's it. Non-attachment. You come on. Oh, yeah, that is not non-attachment. No, we should be, in fact, the sanctity of human relations, family relations is very paramount. It's our duty. Non-attachment here only means when you feel that there are certain things whose association you know very well will be harmful to you, but still you are not able to shake out of it. Habits, ideas, attitudes, many such things. Our habits, ideas, attitudes. Some of them we also want to get rid of. But we are not able to do that. So they impose themselves upon our mindset. So it becomes a kind of enslavement. We want to shake out of all this, but we are not able to do. So to enable us to get freedom out of this entanglement, the word non-attachment is used. It doesn't mean indifference or detachment in a negative sense. No, it means a positive spiritual virtue, which enables you to attain spiritual freedom. So one should do his or her best to her family relations, friends, and others. That's true. But then there are certain circumstances where you feel that it may not be good for you, certain things, certain attitudes, and so on. And you want to get out of it, but you are not able to do that. So there is an invisible chain that binds you to it, which you really want to break, but you are not able to do that. So for that, in such context, the word non-attachment is used. So it becomes a spiritual virtue. Sometimes, you know, the word detachment can have a very wrong interpretation in modern context. It doesn't mean indifference to our friends or relations or family members, not at all. It is only a very, very limited sense. It means when something binds you and becomes a bondage, you also want to get out of it, attitudes, behavior patterns, and so on, then you can use this tool of non-attachment to get out of it. That's the meaning. Okay. How yeah. I can give, for example. Okay, I had a talk with some persons, not here, but in India before coming over to this country. Say, people suffering from alcoholism. You know. See, for example, some youngsters suffering victims of alcoholism. So he wanted to continue his drinking habits to appease his friends, which is really creating problems, his family members, parents, and others. So he wanted to, he was attached to his friends, so to be in their company one. Then there you have to use non-attachment, which is something destructive. to you and to all people around. So certain, that's why certain behavior patterns, attitudes and all that, where you feel you really want to get out of it. The person wanted to get out of it, but he was facing conflicts. So it's really wrong to get out of it. We are good friends, colleagues and professionals. There you can use the subject of non-attachment, which really gives you contentment in the longer run. Otherwise, we disaster the family and to himself. It's a classic example. That's why. It's more of an attitude without any specific focus on individuals. Non-attachment is more of an attitude. Yes. Yes, yeah, please. Yeah, you know, sometimes, of course, in the Yogacara or Vijnanavada system of Buddhism, sometimes called subjective idealism, the many traditional Buddhist scholars don't want to call it the word subjective idealism. It's a Berkeley system, so totally different in a way. So the point is, mind is... mind should be looked upon as a witness, which not a participant in the drama of its experiences or events, but as a witness or a non-participating witness. So there, the mind has to detach itself or non-attach itself from emotions and feelings happening within itself. So what is that mind which sees itself as distinct and different from its own emotions, its own attitudes, its own feelings? That mind in Vedantic language we call Atman because, you know, in Vedanta, mind becomes mind, a functional mind, because Atman's reflection is on mind. Of course. Now, if you are referring to Buddhist philosophy, my answer is something. If you're referring to Vedanta, my answer is something else. What are you referring to? Yes. In that case, it's a Vedantic approach. Now, in Vedantic approach, mind is inert by itself. It becomes functional. It is able to speculate and think and feel and have emotions because the Atman reflects on it. Then it becomes functional. So once the mind detaches itself from its own emotions, then it becomes non-mind. It becomes identified with its Atman. The reflecting medium is mind. And the reflection, then so once you take the mirror away, then what happens? The image reflecting the mirror will merge with the real sun.
So that's what Buddhi means, the mind.
Yes, yeah, you know, Buddhi and mind, mind is called mana and Buddhi is called intellect. So intellect is called Buddhi. These are two different reflecting media in Vedanta. When intellect reflects on Buddhi, then Buddhi is able to discern, decide, understand, recognize. When the same Atman reflects on mind, then mind is able to speculate. To give an example, this we can very easily see. You see an object at a distance. Really, it's an iron pillar. But because there is not enough light, you mistake it for a human form. When you reach it, you realize it is not a human being, it is a pillar, iron pillar. Now, before you come to a decision that it is an iron pillar, you are speculating, is it iron pillar or is it a human being? Sankalpa, vikalpa. Two types of mutually contradictory thought currents. When your mind is functioning, It is always speculative. It is changing. Mutually contradictory thought currents coming one after another. That's why William James called it stream consciousness. Continuous wave of this consciousness. It goes on changing. When you reach the iron pillar, you understand it is iron pillar. So you are decided. Their buddhi or intellect is operating, is functioning. You become content. Yes.
This is more of a comment. When you mentioned the Atman, I was thinking that it's often helpful for me to realize that the Atman is always content, is always
excellent. I was about to come to this very topic next day. But anyway, I will come to that. Our true nature is that we are perpetually in a state of perfect contentment. So discontentment, dissatisfaction, distraction is a foreign body to our mind. It is alien to us. Because in reality, we are the Atman. When we forget this fact, and when we identify ourselves with our body, then the slightest bodily problems, a toothache or a fever, will have an unsettling effect on our mind. If you interpret yourself as the mind, then the slightest mental problem, unhappiness, anxiety, will have a disastrous effect on our system. So, on the other hand, going beyond all this, when we identify ourselves with the real nature, our true nature, Atman, then we will be always in a state of perfect contentment. This is the only permanent answer to this problem of contentment. But I wanted to come to this to us gradually, because in a way, in all traditions, you find we are all coming from a state of perfection, and we are moving towards a state of perfection, contentment. We are coming from a state of contentment. It's our true nature. It's our real home. When we are facing problems, when we are facing discontentment or dissatisfaction, we are in foreign lands. So when we return home, when we come back to the place which is ours, which we belong to, then there will be no discontentment. Once we recognize this, a lot of problems can be solved. But I wanted to slowly come to this subject, because ultimately Gita, you find it, that's what I'm going to deal with in the second chapter of Gita later, maybe today or tomorrow. So the only permanent answer to the question is, if you are talking from a Vedantic perspective, you have to realize that our true nature is Atman. Meaning, very true nature is in a state of perfect contentment, happiness, and tranquility. From a Christian point of view, the true Christian experience, the kingdom of heaven, where you are in a state of perfect spiritual contentment. Or from a Buddhist perspective, the state of nirvana. We say the perfect contentment. A state of perfection towards which we are moving. Because that's the place where we are coming from, and that's the place that we are moving towards. So that's a subject we will deal with in the next discussion, maybe in the second chapter of Gita Sthita Prajna Lakshanas. Thank you for reminding. It's a very wonderful question and wonderful opportunity for me to elaborate on this point. Thank you. So you'll have, I think, 10 minutes more. Please.
More of a question. No, not so much a question, a statement. You're the first person in 40 years of studying Vedanta that said non-attachment is a positive virtue and talked about the sanctity of human relations.
Yeah.
Maybe So going back to that love issue.
Yeah, really.
That's where I live during the week. You know, I may come here and talk about the Atman on the weekend, but during the week, I'm in love, and I need Vedanta to help me there.
Yes, Vedanta doesn't focus on over-asceticism, negation of the realities of life. Rather, it sublimates, it elevates the human relations to a spiritual dimension. And spiritual doesn't mean a world-negating, a world-denying, pessimistic, nihilistic, or over-ascetic ideal. No. Vedanta is a very positive, is a creative. It wants to bring out all your creativity in its full manifestation. So that's the real scope of Vedanta. It sublimates, it elevates the sanctity and the sacredness of human relations. This is a very important theme in Vedanta. It's a very positive. The world negating interpretations are most probably translations, verbal translations in English, very often. Many of the ancient Sanskrit verses, if you translate verbally into English, without really studying from the traditional masters, has this problem. That if you know what happened, the Bible from Greek came to Latin and it took different forms in different languages. So it could happen to all scriptures, but we need not bother. To be very precise, yoga and Vedanta is a very positive, very creative, very constructive, elevating, sublimating philosophy of life. Not a world-negating asceticism, not at all. Okay.
A follow-up to your answer to the question on Dharma, you said do your best.
Yeah. But in reality, in actual experience, when you do your best to do something, your inner system will tell you, I have done my best. That's the ultimate criterion to judge. That's what happens. To give an example, if you're walking the street, if you find a blind man trying to cross the road, if you try to help him or help her, if you get back to your home, you feel an inner. Where does it come from? Similarly, when you do your best, in all sincerity, you will not really have any problem. But your inner system, that's why it's called Atman is within. The inner system will tell you, I have done my best. So, we have 5 minutes. Well, you know, you have to remember, Vedanta is not meant for monks and nuns alone. It's meant for whole humanity, yoga and Vedanta. So, relations, human relations at different levels are fully recognized, and their status is fully recognized and integrated in Vedanta. So, there's one aspect in it, you know. What is the difference between a person who belongs to the physical level and a person who also lives the same life with a Vedantic perspective? The latter one will have a higher perspective. He will not neglect his duties to his friends, his family members, husband to wife, and wife to husband, mother to children, and children. No, he will not neglect. But it will be much more fulfilling. It will be much more complete. He will be able to do it from a higher perspective. Some of the greatest Vedantic teachers who are mentioned in the Upanishadic Vedic literature are our householders. And many of them were hermits, living the hermitages, who have completed their long life as householders and retired to forest hermitages. There, the old wife and husband lived and taught the new generation of students. So, some of the most classic examples of family life you can find in the history of Vedanta. So it is sublimated, it is not negated. Its true position in empirical life, it is not negated, it is sublimated from a higher perspective. So we should remember, first of all, we have a wrong notion that secular should be always different from spiritual. That is wrong. The secular also can be spiritualized. That's the real purpose of Vedanta. People living in families, living in different, belonging to different levels of family life, can also lead spiritual life, at the same time, fulfill their roles as husbands, wife, parents, mother, father, whatever position, sister, brother, in whatever way. So this should be remembered. There is no clear-cut distinction between the secular and spiritual. One, then you may ask the question, what's the difference? The difference is, if you have a spiritual perspective, you will have contentment. If you have a spiritual perspective, then you will realize that life in this world cannot be without problems, if you have a spiritual perspective. If you do not have a spiritual perspective, you have the delusion that life in this world should be completely free from problems, so you get into trouble. That's the only difference, is there. Otherwise, there is no difference between Vedas. Lord Krishna was a husband and the brother, uncle, and he played different roles. So, in the great teacher, Lord Krishna himself was like that. Buddha also was, you know. Buddha was, after all, you know, Buddha had a different perspective, that's all. So, this should remember, the difference between a person who have a spiritual perspective and a person who may not have a spiritual perspective is this. A person who has a spiritual perspective will realize that I have to live in this world, I have to fulfill various roles, but problems are inevitable in this non-eternal, impermanent empirical life. So he will not have problems. If you realize that that problems are part of life, then those problems will no longer be your problems. Problems become problems when you do not expect them. When you have the wrong notion that I can live in this world without any problem. That is impossible. Then only problems arise. Otherwise you will be able to take your problems in your stride. That's the real spiritual wisdom. Right. Oh, attachment to people who passed away. It was not clearly audible. Attachment to people who passed away. Nothing wrong in it. Nothing wrong in it. Oh, you mean people who have passed away. Nothing wrong in it. Well, those who have passed away may have taken a new birth now. I can give an example. Okay, this story will give the right answer to your question. This story in Bhagavata Purana. It's a famous story, but I should give it in a nutshell. A king and his wife, they had a son, and their son was born when they're quite advanced in years, and the son became a very proficient, very efficient youth, and he decided to make him his heir apparent so that he will succeed him as the next king. And all the preparations were ready. Everything was ready for coronation ceremony. That night, the prince died. Chitragedu story in the Bhagavata Purana. The prince died. So the parents, the king and his wife, ministers, all the courtiers, people, they started crying and weeping. So the great sage Narada came to the palace. Let's say an ancient sage. saint. So he tried to console the parents, but he could not, because their only son had just passed away. Then the saint, to demonstrate the truth of what he taught them, what he tried to explain to them, brought back this prince to life. So the prince got up as he was asleep. Then the saint told him, "See, look at your parents who are crying and weeping. You consoled them. Why don't you come back and be the next king? Your father is crying and weeping. Your mother is upset." Then the prince said, "Which mother and father?" He in his mind, there are thousands of pairs of parents lining up. We had gone through so many lives. Remember, this is a subject that needs some explanation. Vedanta and yoga, you don't live only just for one life. You are reborn again. Rebirth, the law of rebirth is very important. It's a given in Vedanta. So the prince could not recognize his parents. That was enough for them. They became wise and they stopped crying and weeping. So the persons about whom you are worried, those persons must be now studying in kindergartens and primary schools and maybe leading happy life. So even if they come back to you, you won't recognize them and they won't recognize you either. So that's what Vedanta will tell you. Okay. Right. So thank you. We'll continue the session at 3:00. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.